Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. It's great to have Bill Shorten back at the Sydney Institute. He was here last in his time as the senior trade union official, and he's back on the first occasion as a parliamentarian and parliamentary secretary. I'll introduce Mr. Shorten briefly because he's well known to you. He graduated in arts and law at Monash University. He worked as a solicitor. He's worked in the trade union movement in senior positions, and since 2007 he's been the member for Maribyrnong in Melbourne, and since the election of the Labor government in 2007, the parliamentary secretary for disabilities. He has other roles, but he's principally here tonight in that capacity to talk on the issue, the future of disabilities, the struggle for equal rights. Mr. Shorten, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Jared. I'm grateful to the Sydney Institute for inviting me to speak tonight. Let me begin by asking you all a question. What do we think a person is worth? What's your value? What's mine? Are we all of equal value in this country? Or are some of us less equal than others? Am I less equal if I cannot go where I want? Or indeed, live where I want? Am I less equal if I can't get a job interview? Am I less equal if I can't complete an education? Am I less equal if I can't enter a building or catch an aeroplane or a train? What if I can't even cast a private ballot in a state or federal election? If you are one of 1.5 million Australians with a severe or profound disability, or one of 600,000 close friends and family members who are unpaid carers, you actually know the answer to that question. And the answer is yes, I am less equal. Yes, I'm not valued according to my potential, but according to my limitations. Yes, my voice is not heard in political discourse sufficiently. Yes, I am a second-class citizen in my own country. Yes, I am less equal. It is still the case in our very lucky special nation that the achievable aspirations of the average Australian remain out of reach for too many people with a severe or profound disability or their carers. A good education, a steady job, owning a home, a role as a valued and respected member of the community, a member of the family who expects reasonably, perhaps, a comfortable retirement in a safe and peaceful place. All of these everyday aspirations remain a distant goal for many people with an impairment. Over the last 30 months, that I have been a parliamentary secretary for disability, I've seen what people with a severe or profound impairment and their carers get. In Australia, it's a life at the margins, by and large. A struggle to find a school that will accept you. Difficulty travelling to university. A struggle to find an employer who will give you a second look for an interview. A smaller pool of rental houses. A life of extra expense, of isolation, and of frustration. This is why I've come to see that a life with disability in Australia is the last frontier of practical civil rights. An issue which doesn't just challenge the democratic principles upon which our Commonwealth was founded. but raises generational challenges for the future prosperity and success of our nation. Tonight I want to make the case that there is a practical civil rights agenda around disability and the inclusion of people with a disability as full members of our society, that it is not special pleading or charity, but in fact it's essential for our country. I don't see disability not as solely as a test for our national morality, but as a test of our national sustainability. Because sooner or later, Australia's governments, industries and communities must address the facts of disability or risk the kinds of social and economic hardships that are now being experienced by nations as diverse as Norway and Italy. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight what I have said is no exaggeration. The stakes are actually this high. The human rights of our fellow Australians are that low. People with disability lack power in our society, they lack organisation, and they lack voice. There is no union for them. There are no powerful disability lobby groups. There is not even, in particular, the equivalent of the choir of hard knocks that's personalised the problems of homelessness. There is no acceptable face, spokesperson, or indeed packaging. There is no single image of an MCG full of the lame, the halt and the blind singing a song of demand for our help. A hero of mine, George Orwell, once said that the problem of being poor is that it takes up all of your time. This goes double for disability. Disability makes you poor. And on top of that, you have to expend your energy dealing with systems that were never designed with you in mind. People with disability and their carers are exhausted. They spend so much time surviving that they have little time left for thriving. The disability sector and individuals try valiantly to patch the immediate holes in our creaky system, but they haven't been able to convince the rest of our nation that this important issue is actually an urgent issue. In my view, there can be no real change without disability becoming an urgent political issue and wielding the political clout that the numbers demand. With that in mind, tonight I'd like to accomplish three things. One, I want to explain why disability matters to all of us. Two, I'd like to explain why as a nation, in business, in the community and in government, we need to change the way we think about disability. And three, I'd like to explain why it's in the national interest to bring disability in from the cold and make it a mainstream concern. Before I go into why disability matters, let me give you an example of how it struggles to gain mainstream attention. Recently, before June the 23rd, I was invited to appear on the ABC TV program Q&A. On the night, though, not one question made it through on disabilities, because, of course, 4 days before the program, Julia Gillard became our Prime Minister. When, in the dying moments of the show, I broached the issue of a national disability insurance scheme and stated that disability was at least as important as other questions of national politics, I was accused by Barnaby Joyce of spinning, of giving a line. What's the point of that story? It's not about Barnaby Joyce. It is that disability is not a mainstream media issue. Now, there are notable exceptions in the media, but generally, indeed today in the Sydney Morning Herald and the Daily Telegraph, but generally, disability is seen as an issue outside the realm of everyday life. It is something that doesn't concern us, and it is therefore quarantined as a subject for the one-off specials or sensationalism, tragedy or heroism, but seldom for sustained investigation. To use the media vernacular, disability just isn't sexy. But let me tonight tell you why disability is sexy. According to the latest statistics from the Australian Bureau of Statistics, and this was in 2003, there are about 1.5 million people with a severe or profound impairment. Severe or profound impairment loosely means people requiring assistance with one of the core functions of living, be it speaking or moving around. Half of these Australians are under the age of 65. This year, state and federal governments will spend about $6 billion on care and support for these under-65s in aids and equipment, in home and community care and day services. I'm not referring to pensions and I'm not referring to employment. $6 billion. This system is propped up by the unpaid work of hundreds of thousands of primary carers, many of whom are ageing parents. It is a system in perpetual crisis, as any family member knows. But I would suggest this crisis is set to become a catastrophe as the numbers grow. Many carers simply won't be able to keep shouldering the burden. As a consequence, in 10 years, the cost of supporting people with a disability aged under 65 is projected to jump by 66% to $10 billion a year in current dollar values. And in 20 years, $17 billion. Currently, the states are spending $4 billion. In 20 years, they'll have to be finding $11 billion just to keep pace. This is just a beginning. Every year, about 30,000 children under the age of 15 acquire a health condition, potentially leading to a disability. There are now estimated to be 180,000 children under the age of 15 with a severe or profound disability. Every year, nearly 10,000 Australians under the age of 30 enter the disability support pension system. Most will stay on it for life. There are now nearly 800,000 Australians receiving the disability support pension at all ages, costing nearly $12 billion a year, separate to the numbers I quoted earlier. Every person with a disability aged 20 who enters and stays in the mainstream workforce rather than spending their life on the disability support pension will save the government nearly $600,000 in service outlays. They'll pay taxes. There'll be less need for government-funded care and support. And by the way, they'll have a better life experience. The inadequacy of the disability system is impacting on other areas of critical need, such as acute health and corrections. Our prisons have become an institution of last resort for too many people with an intellectual disability. People with intellectual disabilities in our prison system are scandalously overrepresented. It's been estimated that in New South Wales alone, over 20% of the current inmates of jails have an intellectual disability. Too many young people with a disability remain in age-inappropriate nursing homes rather than with people their own age. We have reduced the numbers, but there are still nearly 7,000 people under 65 in aged care because there's nowhere else for them to go. People with disabilities are often parked in hospitals until more suitable service arrangements can be found, a very expensive way to support people. One project in the New South Wales Lifetime Care and Support Authority reduced hospital lengths of stay by up to 83 days by opening up community options in some categories of severe spinal cord injury, saving nearly $100,000 per patient. What does all of this tell us? It says that unless we do something now, more and more Australians will be forced to drop out of the workforce to care for loved ones. Our economy will be hamstrung by an acceleration in terms of the fall of labour participation rates. State governments will be driven to the verge of financial bankruptcy by rising disability service costs. And Australians with a disability will continue to be increasingly marginalised and segregated. And I believe that sooner or later there'll be a very real risk of a return faced with this cost crisis, a return to the dark ages of institutionalisation. And by the way, what if all the carers went on strike? What if they costed themselves as employees and asked to be paid? No, they won't, because love drives them. But we should support and value this love of the parents, the siblings and the children, not take it for granted. As dire as things are, real progress has been made since our government was elected at the end of 2007, and I should acknowledge the contribution of Senior Minister Jenny Macklin in this area. We have doubled the money that we give the states for our National Disability Agreement, taking it to over $5 billion over 5 years, which is twice as much over 5 years than was paid in the previous period. And we've introduced better benchmarking. We've certainly increased the carer's allowance and also the disability support pension by $100 per fortnight. We've changed the disability employment networks and we've ended waiting lists for people with disability to be supported to find open employment. We've created the Helping Children with Autism package, for the first time giving funding, $6,000 rebates per year, to parents of children with autism up to the age of six. We delivered, after a decade of delay, the first access to premises for public buildings. We're amongst the first of the OECD nations to have signed the United Nations Convention on Rights of People with Disability and indeed ratified the optional protocol. And I think most importantly, we've established the Productivity Commission inquiry into the possibility of a lifetime care scheme, a social insurance scheme, in Australia. Now, these changes are not enough, not by a long shot. In short, the current model cannot cope. I've spoken to our Prime Minister about this. She's shown great empathy and understanding of the real lives that people with disability are living now. She has the vision to understand why more reform is in the national interest and why doing nothing is not an option. Tonight, I suggest that we need a new approach, a new model that's all about driving better and more coordinated service delivery and outcomes, facilitating community and indeed economic participation by people with disabilities. By 2030, according to the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, there'll be 2.3 million people with a severe or profound disability, but there'll be no increase in carers automatically. In fact, there's likely to be a drop as the elderly parents of adult children with disability become too old to look after their children. There are already too many exhausted midnights of sleepless anxiety for too many. There is a great wave of need on the horizon, and unless we change our way of thinking and the priority to which we attach to disability, we run the risk of being swept away. But to shift our way of thinking from old ideas and attitudes towards disability is a big task. It will require the efforts not just of government, but the whole of our community. We need to admit that the way we live and work, from maternal child and healthcare centres and schools, to shopping centres and public transport, to housing and workplaces, has been designed without consideration for the needs of people with disability. For instance, even in the upcoming federal election, the Labor Party has two blind candidates, Tony Clark and Stephen Hurd, standing for the House of Representatives seats in Victoria. Tony and Stephen are strong candidates and would make excellent MPs. They happen to have a problem. They can't cast a secret ballot. The secret ballot's been a cornerstone of a democratic system. It was first introduced in Victoria in 1855. But 155 years on, voters with a visual impairment still have to trust someone to fill out their ballot paper for them. The secret ballot should be universal by next year, but we have one segment of the community which has had to wait a sesquicentenary for a basic democratic protection. Now, I want to talk about the broader community, including business, how they can make a difference to disability. But before I do, I would like to explain my personal thinking behind the proposed National Disability Insurance Scheme. Late last year, we announced the federal government that the Productivity Commission would conduct an inquiry into the feasibility of a long-term care and support scheme for people with disability, including the investigation of a national disability insurance scheme. This is not just going to be another inquiry. We've had many inquiries historically into the problems of disability. This is the first time we're having one into a solution for disability. The Productivity Commission has released an issues paper in May which made the case for major changes in disability. It's due to report by the end of July next year. The Commission had this to say about the disability system. And I quote, "The key question is not how bad the current system is. Nearly everyone thinks it needs to be overhauled. What we want to know is how to build a good system." And it said, "The Commission is starting from the position that the broad rationale for some form of mandated contributions to provide disability support is soundly based, whether through taxation, compulsory contributions to insurance, or other means. The key question at this stage is how best to design a system that achieves this goal. After all, as I've said earlier, demand for services is growing at a rate of 7% per year. Much of the discussion about an insurance scheme will be about how much it will cost and how it will be funded. I don't intend to preempt the Productivity Commission on these issues, and I cannot predict either the Commission's findings nor the government's response. But what I do want to make the point is that we're spending a huge amount of money already on a system that isn't working. Australian governments spend collectively around $23 billion a year on the total of the disability welfare system, not just the $6 billion in services. About $8 billion goes in payment to community care and support providers. There's nearly $3 billion in payments to families and other informal carers. We're pouring our water into a series of leaky buckets. Sticking with the current system is a false economy. I'm interested in whether or not a shift to a system that intervenes early, that offers individualised support and care, and that follows a person through their life will deliver savings in the long term. More importantly, it will ease that relentless anxiety faced by people with a disability and their carers about their future. What would a national disability insurance scheme involve in practice? I'd like to use an example of the good system that you have in New South Wales or the Traffic Accident Commission in Victoria for people who have been seriously injured in a motor vehicle accident. The scheme pays for the rehabilitation, treatment and care of people in car accidents. This includes medical and dental treatment, rehabilitation and respite care. It covers home and vehicle modification, aids and equipment, as well as vocational training and education. I'm sure these schemes aren't perfect and can't pay for everything that a person who's been paralysed or suffered a severe brain injury needs. But at least there is a structure, at least there is a pathway for that person to enter after they have to deal with the shock and the pain of their injury. They are not told if they come at the wrong time in the financial year that there is no more package and come back at the beginning of the next financial period. This scheme, for the limited pool who qualify, I suggest is an island of optimism in an ocean of pessimism. But compare this with the situation of a person who suffers an identical injury in an accident at home, or is the victim of violence, or a chance swimming accident. Unless they're able to win in the lottery of a court case, if in fact they have a compensable injury, they will fall back on the patchwork system which is already stretched beyond capacity. Indeed, compare that of the motor vehicle accident victim to those with a couple whose 18-month-old child has been diagnosed with autism. That couple walk out of the doctor's office and they're on their own. They're left disoriented, grieving and scrambling to access services, the speech therapists, the occupational therapists, the psychologists, all the help which you need, and indeed to access long-term medical advice for their child. Parents of children with autism have made it clear to me that they earn their PhD from Google University because it's the only place they can go for information. We do know that with autism, good early intervention does make a huge difference for life. So the clock is ticking and the opportunities are slipping away from the moment of diagnosis. And even if parents manage to find some help, they find that the earth is flat. You know, back in the 13th century, we were told that if you sailed too far, you'd sail off the end of the world. We now know that the world is round, except for a few who think it's a conspiracy. But when you have a parent of a child with a developmental delay at an early age, your world is still flat. You sail off the end of the world when you look for those early intervention services. You sail off the world again when you try and find a school, be it in the special system or the mainstream system, at primary school. You sail off again when you find a secondary school. You sail off the end of the world when you're made to feel like a bully to seek support at the school for resources. You have these collisions, these departures, this need to start again at every stage in the life cycle. To me, the question which the Commission should answer is how do we move the level of care and support offered to a child with autism or another developmental delay, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, to something approaching that of a person injured in a car accident in New South Wales or Victoria? How do we ensure that the child with autism or Down syndrome or a hearing or vision impairment has the best experience they can have at school? Because you have an impairment doesn't mean you can't learn. The best chance they have to get a job, because you have an impairment, doesn't mean that you can't work. To live a life that is as independent and satisfying as possible. To ensure that you're not defined by your one inability, but by the whole complex nature of your personality with all its marvellous abilities. Why should the quality of care in Australia depend on where and how the impairment occurs, not the needs created by the impairment? I don't think there's any doubt the government has a lead role to play in the creation of a new approach to disability through initiatives such as the proposed NDIS. But it's an issue which is too big for government alone. We need the mighty Australian private sector to buy in. Private enterprise triggers $7 out of every 10 in the Australian economy, and it can therefore drive enormous change. Business should also appreciate that focusing on disability is good for business, because I believe that a lifetime care and support system has the potential, and the re-engagement of so many carers and so many people with disability, has the potential to create a multi-billion dollar marketplace for goods and services specifically designed to cater for the needs of people with disability. For instance, earlier this year, the government announced the first set of national access to premises standards, that's public buildings. It took 10 years of complex negotiations to put these standards into place. That's longer than the Trojan War. It covers public buildings, as I've said, not private homes. Late last year, I had the opportunity to set up a dialogue to talk about the issue of universal housing design. We involved the Master Builders and the Housing Industry Association, the architects, the property council, the real estate industry. I brought along representatives of the seniors groups, people with disabilities and government departments. The adversarial approach has not worked and takes too long, and we don't have 10 years to wait. We are able to see the role of government not as the regulator, but using its authority to encourage the stakeholders to develop new standards and approaches to residential housing design. Today out in Western Sydney, Ropes Crossing, the result of this dialogue, we launched a voluntary, signed to by all the players within the housing industry, a livable design strategy for private homes. It sets an aspirational target that all new homes will be built to an agreed standard by 2020. For those of you who don't realise, livable design is a simple way of building homes so that they can be lived in easily by people with disability or the frail aged, or just those with a temporary mobility impairment. Wider doors, reinforced bathroom walls for future shower rails are easier and cheaper to build now than to retrofit. Moses did not come down from the mountain and say that door frames in Australia in new houses should be 700 millimetres wide. And over the next 10 years, we're moving them to 850 millimetres. And as someone pointed out, that'll mean fewer bricks, so it'll be cheaper. The case for building homes where a person can spend their whole lives is in fact strong. The case for building a home that can be on-sold to the widest range of possible buyers is very compelling. I think that universal design, livable housing design, is a bit like green design, sustainable design was 20 years ago. The case for it is strong, but it hasn't been made to the consumer. There are no rating systems up till today, or stickers telling you how adaptable your home will be when it gets older, or if you have a child with a disability, or indeed if you're a young mum with a child, if you get injured, or if you have friends with an impairment over for the night. Industries realise this. It's ahead of government. That's why the Property Council and all those other groups have been so willing to be involved. We hear about the green dollar, we hear about the pink dollar. I would like to suggest there's a disability dollar, or indeed a livable dollar. And that when companies realise that people with disability are an untapped market, they're consumers, not charity. They're opportunities, not costs. I think we need to turn around the way that we look at people with disability. There are some areas where regulation is necessary, but I believe that we can do most of our changes without the heavy hand of regulation. I think that where companies embrace new technology and creative thinking, they understand they can make a profit by providing services adapted for people with disability. I'd also like to suggest tonight that there is a marvellous productivity dividend. For every 10,000 full-time carers you release back into the job market, into the economy, it's estimated that for every carer who goes back into work, there's an additional $50,000 a year generated. For 10,000 carers, that becomes $500 million of economic activity. In conclusion, let me just say this. Before I was elected into politics, I spent 14 years in the trade union movement. I thought I knew my country, and I travelled to many parts of it and seen, indeed, sometimes egregious examples of disadvantage. But I didn't know my country. The past 30 months have opened my eyes. Hidden in plain sight are more than 2 million Australians who are citizens in name, but in reality they're more like exiles in their own country. Wouldn't build a wall around a city of 2 million Australians and say, you will have inferior outcomes to the rest of Australia. That's what we do when disability doesn't receive the attention it deserves. We have too many Australians who are less than equal citizens. I think it's shameful, but I also think it's silly. And it's a loss of Australian potential. I think there is a chance, a window of opportunity, to end that inequality. And I think in that process, secure the future prosperity of our nation. Thanks very much for listening.
Many thanks, Mr. Shorten. So we come to questions and discussion, but before we do, I should say a formal thanks to Clayton Yutt for using this fine facility this evening. So we come to questions and discussion. As you know from your understanding of Australian history, the concept of social insurance goes back a long way to between the First and Second World War. Never properly pulled off, often spoken about. It's a big ticket item. I know there's a Productivity Commission hearing, but how do you see that developing?
It is a big ticket item. First of all, the government made the very wise decision to recommend that the Productivity Commission, who are independent, they're independent of government, they will form their own conclusions. They'll do so, though, using some of the best economists in the nation. I think that their issues paper shows that they think there's a case for change. But beyond that, the first step is, what is the system that they'll propose that should be designed? Someone wise once said that good ideas are at their most vulnerable at the implementation stage. So I accept the time spent working out the design of this system is time well spent. Then, of course, we'll get to the issue of how much it would cost. I accept that that'll be an issue, again, of priority. And there are many competing issues which require our attention. The proposition which I'm advancing for consideration tonight is not what the ultimate scheme will look like, or indeed not what the government will do. It'll consider all the facts based on the best information possible. What I'm advancing tonight is that the status quo, I suggest, is not an option. We already, and whatever scheme is designed, or if there is a scheme proposed, it shouldn't be done comparing it to a vacuum. We already have an income support system. We already have a range of compensation systems. We already have a range of private insurance, and we have a lot of gaps. We also have a lot of our carers not deployed in the workforce. Full-time carers suffer a lot more chronic illness, are a lot more susceptible to mental illness, have no superannuation, and they do live, I have to say, fundamentally, lives of constant anxiety. So there's a productivity dividend, I suspect there's a health dividend, by changing the way we do business. It always comes back in part to the money, and I'm not naive about that, but I think that if you're able to identify a stream of income and support which moves it beyond the patchwork now, if it has the focus on an individualised system where people can have some control over the resources they receive, then we've got to allow the natural ingenuity, the native capacity of people to pursue their own self-interest to kick in. I just think we need to lift the tide to a point where people have enough where they can pursue their own opportunities regardless of their impairment. So I haven't answered the question about how much the big ticket is or whether or not there's a willingness to do it. Those issues are in the future. What I do believe, though, is that disability is an issue which needs to be addressed. And I think by any measurement, it's one which has been neglected. And despite our efforts in our first term, I think there is an appetite, an interest in disability, which is greater than, for want of a better collective noun, that the Canberra Press Gallery realise. It's a bigger issue than just the 24-hour news cycle, and there is an appetite out in our communities around Australia. Doesn't matter if it's Toorak or Toowoomba, there is an appetite to do something on this topic, which I think should be tapped into and utilised.
It was so refreshing to hear you thinking it through in a new way tonight, the whole problem. As a friend of a person who is the parent of a now 40-something autistic man, she has spent 3 decades with the autistic group in Victoria, people who know exactly the problem, fighting with bureaucrats about the kind of accommodation, the sorts of things that government money could be used to do. Is there any chance that that sort of regulation we know best handed down from bureaucracy idea could be put to one side and allow the people who are actually dealing with cases have more say in the kinds of regulations allowed for, say, housing, cost of housing. I mean, in Victoria, apparently, even cost of housing was banned for ages. But is there any breakthrough on that after 3 or 4 days?
There already is. Not. I should be clear that a national disability insurance scheme, if it was to happen, and if it could be afforded, two big ifs, it's certainly not going to answer all the issues. One of the principles which is already filtering through, and to be fair to my Victorian brothers and sisters, I think Victorian jurisdiction, along with Western Australia, are probably the most advanced on this question, which will immediately see I get phone calls from all those other ministries I didn't mention tomorrow. But in terms of individualised funding is the idea that rather than handing funding to block service providers who then administer services to people with high needs, that you provide the package to the family. Now, it's funny. People think that because... It's not funny. It's ironic that people think that, on one hand, we believe that individuals are the best... You know, we don't make people pay 100% tax and then feed them at 3 times a day in Australia. We don't make them all wear uniforms or catch certain buses. When it comes to disability, there is a certain scepticism that if you provide money to families or to people with disabilities, that they will proverbially waste it up against a tree, which is not the case. I've become quite a fan in the last 30 months of individualised funding. I would trust a family and an individual to administer $80,000 better than a service. Not because the service is ill-intentioned, and I certainly see a role for big services, and there's some here tonight, so I don't want you all ringing me tomorrow as well. Saying, Bill, we thought you loved us. I do, but the point is, I think that the most efficient allocation of resources in disability that I see is the possibility of individualised packages. Now, people who get those individualised packages still need to operate on good information. They need to have choice. They need to be services. They need to have a proper skilled workforce. They need assistance in, you know, making sure they get independent advice. So it's, but I think the basic thrust of the question, which was much briefer than the answer, is that individualised funding is certainly one of the things which I hope to see the Productivity Commission discuss. But that's underway, and in our National Disability Agreement, which the federal government signed with all the states in the end of May in 2008, one of the priorities is we want to see states and territories moving to a greater proportion of individualised services. You know, I think the conversation's got to be not just between government and service providers, but put the person who actually requires the service in the middle of the dialogue. So I think there will be progress in that area anyway.
Anthony. Thank you very much for addressing us tonight. Following on from that, the recent trade agreement talked about states taking over responsibility in this area. How do you see that working in practice in, you know, this new way that you're talking about we reach... If we end up with that, what sort of skills and governance do states need in this area to do a better job than the Commonwealth might be able to do?
It's been an interesting challenge the last 2 years working with states. I mean, states are closer to people in terms of service delivery. Commonwealth not all wisdom resides at the Commonwealth level. There's a lot of very skilled people working at the state level in the area of disabilities, and I can think of some very impressive public servants at the state level who got their finger on the pulse of what's happening. We have a range of agreements where we provide funding to states. There's a National Disability Agreement. We've moved in the area of aged care to provide the home and community care funding for disability services under 65 to the states. What we do have to do is get better at working out with the states measurement of what they're doing and accountability. You know, I do get boxed about the ears on a regular basis from families who say, well, you've said you'd give an X billion to the states. Where's it going? So we ring up our friends in the state ministerial offices and they say, well, are you asking us for data again? So I do think there is a process which could be more transparent than it is. But we've now got benchmarking. We're now getting the states to measure unmet need. It shouldn't have taken 2 years, but we've now got a common national definition of what respite care is, what the common measurement of services. So I think we are making progress on that, and that's hard work by the states and territories as well to achieve that. I think, again, though, if we could do something more about providing more streamlined funding, and early intervention doesn't just mean for toddlers. Early intervention means that when you acquire impairment, you've got a coach or a PA even, or a case manager. I see this to use an example of the bushfires. The federal and state government provided 350 case managers for people who had suffered bereavement, lost their houses, you know, been seriously dislocated by those terrible tragedies of February the 7th and the other fires last year. But we're able to give people a case manager. Now, sometimes the case manager wasn't appropriate. To send a young 21-year-old social worker from the inner city out to a farmer didn't always work. Sometimes it did. So you've got to get the right case manager, but you know, if we can do it, then I think the idea that when a family gets a diagnosis for their child, or indeed as an adult develops an early onset disease, I think that part of a system should be that across Australia, it doesn't have to be run by the Commonwealth, but we know that there'll be a case manager who'll say, OK, well, this is what's available for vehicle modifications, this is what you can claim on GST, or this is your disability discrimination rights, or this is how we can help you stay in the job you're in, or this is where the range of cerebral palsy early intervention services are. Families spend a lot of time just trying to find out what is going on. So I think that there's probably improvements we can do through an NDIS, if we achieve one, or some form of lifetime care, which just joins the system up for people. I've partly answered your question, Anthony. I don't pretend I've answered it all, because your question's a whole talk on its own.
Right down the back, against the window.
Bill, do you have any theories as to why culturally or sociologically, historically, it is so bad in Australia? I'm not talking about pointing fingers to blame, but it seems to me that we need to understand why culturally and sociologically in Australia it is so much worse than in comparable countries, and what it is about the attitude of Australians in general,
before we really know how we can move on, not only to change it, but to bring the population in general along with the need for change. So what was your name?
Sue.
Sorry, I can't see through the light. So, Sue, you do know a fair bit, so the next statement I make, I do so with some trepidation. I don't think Australia is a lot worse than comparable nations. I think some nations do some things better than us. I think the UK does AIDS and equipment, from what I observe, better, and I think New Zealand has some aspects of care which we could learn from. Having said that, regardless of what other nations are doing, and we should be informed by what other nations are doing, I think some Australians, they're individually generous and compassionate, but I think sometimes when some Australians deal with people with disability, if they're not immediate family, they feel uncomfortable. I can't analyse why some people feel uncomfortable dealing with disability. Maybe it's a reminder of our own frailty, our own mortality. It's a reminder that but for a shaft of DNA fate, that could be us. Maybe some people are uncomfortable with diversity. We see that in other issues in Australia. I do think that one of the challenges is to get disability groups to work together better than they do. It would be good if all the disability groups had the same point of view in terms of some common solutions. I do think it is possible to change people's attitudes, but I think it's exposure to issues of disability. I know I certainly had a bit of a breakthrough moment when I was fortunate enough to go to the Beijing Paralympics. Now, I won't judge any of you, but I'm not an elite athlete, if you hadn't. Anyway, we won't go there. But the point is, what I saw in Beijing, initially you could see people who have got quite overtly significant impairments. But you work out pretty quickly. You stop looking at the impairment, you say, oh, what event is that athlete in? And you understand when you watch our Australia in a wheelchair basketball team or our Australian wheelchair rugby team, or you watch swimmers in the pool. You watch the village, which was, I'm not saying China's a model for all about disability, but I do say that for a moment in that village it was designed for people with impairment to move around in. You saw teams and families and supporters and trainers and athletes, and you looked at people, I think, very positively. And you cease to notice the impairment, and you certainly were watching their abilities and their remarkable feats of athleticism. Paralympians are not people with disabilities first. They're elite athletes who happen to have an impairment. The reason why I've gone at length on that point, Sue, is I think if we had more positive portrayal of disability in the media, I think that would change people's attitudes. Disability is an issue which, if it affects you, you know about it. But if it doesn't affect you, you're unfamiliar with it. I don't think that's an ungracious attitude. I just think it's an attitude of not knowing. I don't think Australian politics is any more backward than other places, but I do think it requires a sustained push to put it on the agenda. So again, I've partly answered your observation, Sue, and Sue's involved with a group of carers and people interested in disability called Mad as Hell. You know, I encourage you to go to their website. So we'll give you a more fiery answer than that, but you know, we're on the same wavelength pretty much.
There's a question down there. Okay. Go be quick, we don't have a lot of time.
Was that directed at me, Jared?
Apparently, the family decided to talk. First of all, thank you for your championing of the cause of disability. In terms of the National Disability Insurance Scheme, a fundamental principle of insurance is limiting liability.
Yeah.
So, how do you propose to integrate both preventative and primary care into the mix so that we get the minimum amount of disability in the community to start with, so that we have better ability to service the needs of the disabled as they develop?
We've got, in the audience, we've got a very eminent actuary, John Walsh. John's over to my left, over to everyone else's right. John's the Associate Commissioner for the Productivity Commission study. So anything I say in terms of numbers and liability and compensation, John's one of my mentors in terms of this, and he'll have much better numbers than I do. But in Australia, if you were to say that for every 8 people who have a severe and profound impairment, 2 in every 8 acquire them traumatically. 6 in every 8, roughly, not traumatically. Of that 2 in 8, 1 in that 8, and this is on an annual basis, 1 in that 8 might have a compensable claim. The other one, you know, it could be the swimming injury off the pier in the river, could be domestic violence, sporting injury, or, you know, non-compensable traumatic injury. If we look at about limiting liability, I'm not interested in ripping up systems that are working. We have a sort of a balance. I think for some insurance bods, they see a national disability insurance scheme as a chance to ping the Labor lawyers. You know, that to me is a debate at the margins. I do support the existence of tort law. I think that sometimes things are achieved by the ability to sue people. And where there's working systems and workers' comp and traffic accidents, I personally don't see this as changing what's working. But what I also recognise is what's happening to the other 7 and 8. And I do believe that some of the structure of a largely non-fault system has a lot to attract it in terms of how we manage costs and how we manage payments. It would initially require, I believe, the creation of an ongoing revenue stream which would just be invested. But that's one idea of a model. John will have others, and the Productivity Commission will no doubt come down with some propositions. I see a big role, though, for the concept of insurance as opposed to just leaving it to the current system of doling out money on a limited, finite budgetary basis.
I want to congratulate you on a very interesting talk in your program. And my daughter just last week came out of the Royal Adelaide Hospital. She's been there for 4 months in the psychiatric ward. She suffers from schizophrenia, and I'm really grateful she was there because she may, I think, would probably have suicide had we not taken her. But for 4 months, she could not step out of doors. 4 months, right? They closed Hillcrest. The company was selling more land off Glenside. They're going to sell it to the Film Commission. In New South Wales, had she gone to the Royal Prince Alfred, would have been exactly the same because they've closed Callan Park. This idea that you have to stay indoors because when you're mentally ill, you're not flat on your back. You're walking around, and you're walking around a lot. And if you can get out to nature, if you can get a place which has a garden and a secure fence, you can walk about because you often don't want to talk to other people. You don't like other people.
Okay.
You're much better. Now, I believe...
One more... No, we've got to stop there. The suggestion is
I believe this applies to a lot of the elderly as too. I see elderly people in nursing homes and they never get out of doors.
Okay, the suggestion is that people who are mentally ill or old should have greater access outside of the...
I take that more as a well-informed statement than I agree.
I congratulate you on taking on your role over the last 30 months so conscientiously and so candidly describing the challenges and responsibilities we have as a nation. I haven't heard any other public representative do that to this degree. And I wonder if we have anything to learn from New Zealand's accident compensation system.
I think we do. In part, that doesn't cover all forms of impairment, but it covers traumatically acquired impairment. You've got to make sure the system's funded properly. But... I mean, if the Kiwis can do it, I don't see why we can't. So I do think there's something to learn there. I do think there are international parallels for us. I'm very mindful, you know, politics today can be quite toxic. As soon as you talk about a new idea, then someone else will say, big new tax. You know, it depends. But the point about what I would say there is, let's look at before we ask people to pay for a motor car, let's design it and see if it works. I accept that's a legitimate part of the debate. But let's not kill the issue of disability too quickly by trying to say, well, it's going to cost X or Y billion dollars. And I'm not saying, I was a director of superannuation funds for a decade, sort of employed hundreds of people in my time. I get that bills have to be paid. I help pay my own household bills. But the point about all of that is, I think there's a better way we can do things, and in the long run, it is possible to do disability better and just re-engage a lot of people. And so I think economically, it's not just looking at New Zealand. You know, as I say to some of my colleagues, you know, and they roll their eyes a bit, but, you know, I've got an economic portfolio, and I've just got a welfare portfolio. I think that's the way we need to look at disability.
So we're getting near the end. There's one question here, there's one there, there's one there. Might be it, yeah?
Let me breathe. Bill Graham, I have a daughter with a mild to medium level intellectual impairment and physical impairment, and I have a son with physical impairment and a couple others that don't have any, which is nice. Specifically, you spoke about the problems of mental illness and the problems that creates. You've spoken about Paralympians and the problems of physical impairment. The only reference to those with mental impairment, not mental illness, but an actual mental deficiency, those we frankly used to call retarded, was to say that they account for 20% of the prison population. You also referred to the fact that gainfully employing people, any of them, creates a better quality of life and also stimulates the economy. With a 21-year-old daughter who is mentally retarded but capable of functioning in society, we cannot get her a job because she can't be trusted to work unsupervised, but she doesn't qualify for a pension. And the reason she can't be employed is because everybody who would employ her, such as a nursing home to be a companion to aged people, a childcare centre to simply sit and play with small children, those sort of non-revenue generating but gainful employments are now off limits because they can't take her on the premises because of insurance constraints. I've seen multiple childcare centres employ my daughter. I'll pay her salary. It will be zero cost to you. Just have her come here every day and sit and play with children, and repeatedly we are told that intellectually disabled people are a burden who are a risk that has to be insured against, and therefore there's a premium. And even when you say, fine, I will pay the increase in your insurance premium so that she can come on the premises, they go to their insurers and they take this up, and the insurers say, no, we will not cover these people on site. Full stop. Could you address?
Sorry, yeah, I can.
All that by way of setting the scene. Can you tell me, does your vision, your personal vision of disability services, extend to changing the way that insurance companies and therefore corporates operate?
Okay. Yes. I mean, there was a fair bit of what you said, Graham, but just to be clear, I did mention developmental intellectual disability more than once, and a lot of the numbers I used, obviously, incorporate people with intellectual and developmental delays from early intervention right through. But having said that, I know that in my time as the Parliamentary Secretary, we've introduced a traineeship for people with intellectual disability in my own department because it was ridiculous. We didn't employ people as trainees. There are programs around. In the most recent budget, whilst there wasn't a lot of new money announced, there was two programs for employment programs of nearly $14 million for people with intellectual disability. So not only will I get my staff member to get your details and we'll see, and I'll get the Department of Employment to have a chat to you to see what can be done. The broader issue which you'll raise about insurance, it's a furphy. They can insure. I don't accept that the idea that someone with an intellectual disability is some sort of insurance risk. I don't accept that. So people who are saying that, in my opinion, are discriminating. And so that's a separate issue which we'll take up. So I'm saying, yeah, I think your daughter can find work, and by the way, not all work has to be paid, and you know, not. I don't view people with disabilities as necessary economic actors alone. They're social actors. They're people going, you know, not everyone has to have the job, so they don't all have to work in open employment. So
but they need a purpose.
But they need a purpose, and I'm saying we'll follow up your particular case, and as some people will attest to you, sometimes we resolve it, and sometimes the system defeats us. But we're happy to have a go with you.
We're wrapping up in 5 minutes. We've got two questions. One here, and John down the back. Yep.
It's interesting. Sorry, I'm Phoebe. that exam. It's interesting to hear you mention Beijing Olympic. Now, in China, the disability population is 60 million. Mm. While you were in Beijing, were there anything you could see that we can learn from?
The point is that in China, the total number of those who are disabled is 60 million, and did you pick up anything in China?
I have to say, the Olympics I did, but I visited some other services. And, okay. I think that disability occupied... I'm not going to cause an international incident here. I went to a place where AusAid provides hydrotherapy baths, you know, beyond the fifth concentric road around Beijing. They certainly have a ministry of disability. It was a pretty important portfolio. We met their senior politicians. I think the numbers are even bigger than 60 million, I have to say. So they're certainly very conscious of it. They had a well-established departmental structure. I can't say I particularly scratched the surface. I did visit a couple of services. But I have to say they did the Beijing Paralympics tremendously well. And I'm sure we did in Sydney, but I think Beijing certainly fulfilled the standards we set in Sydney. So that's something I learned.
Final question, John O'Neill.
Thanks very much for that presentation. I was wondering if there are any people at goodwill in the Liberal Party that will see this issue as important, as I'm sure most Australians did, as well as people have presented here tonight. But surely there are. Isn't this such an important issue that it can be a bipartisan issue?
There are, and I will. Certainly someone like Senator Sue Boyce from Queensland is quite remarkable, and I listen very carefully when she talks about disability because of her personal experience. She's got a longer parliamentary track record than I do about these matters, and she's a Lib Senator from Queensland. When I've talked about disability issues, I have had generous support from a range of individual Lib and Nat MPs, as I have had from Labor MPs and Green MPs. I do believe that there's a genuine interest in the NDIS. Tony Abbott has said he will look carefully at the proposals of the National Disability Insurance Scheme. So I'm not going to verbal them in any fashion. I will say positively about Labor rather than negatively about the Liberals. We've given the intellectual firepower to this question the last 2.5 years, and I'll also say this. If disability is a fundamentally important issue to you, we're the ones that put this idea on the table. But I can't say that the Libs have been... there are plenty of individual Libs who've taken an interest in these matters. Absolutely.
Many thanks. Take a seat. Well, many thanks to the Parliamentary Secretary and for all of you coming along tonight. We could have gone on a lot longer, but we always finish on time, and I'm glad that everyone, there's so many people here who feel strongly about the issue, everyone behaved themselves, and that was really great. So, it was an orderly night. If we had had a function on this issue perhaps some years ago, I'm not sure that we would have filled the room. I think it's a credit to Bill Shorten that we've more than filled the room. Without question, Bill Shorten has done an enormous amount to put this issue on the public agenda, and not only in his various speaking roles, but in his occasional television and radio appearances. And we've seen him here tonight with the enthusiasm and the knowledge that he brings to the issue. So I'd just like to say to the Parliamentary Secretary, well done, congratulations, and we'll see you again sometime. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.